Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Banana Bag Oral Solution. These are definitely not your typical dehydration supplement. In fact, they're my personal go-to after a long surf session when I'm looking to avoid exhaustion and dehydration. Check them out at bananabag.org and use promo code STAYSTOKED for 10% off your purchase. You'll also get free shipping if you join their mailing list. Joining me today from Rhode Island is colleague and surf buddy, Jesse Reiblich. Jesse's an attorney and expert in coastal and marine law and policy, and he teaches and researches at the University of Rhode Island in the Marine Affairs Department. Jesse's published on many topics, including coastal access and equity, climate change policy, the public trust doctrine, water law, coastal adaptation, the California Coastal Act, and surf break protection. His upcoming research will focus on environmental justice concerns in the U.S. territories, coastal access and recreation, and the efficacy of statutory coastal laws. For today's episode, we'll be chatting about his article, A Global Review of Legal Protection Mechanisms for the Management of Surf Breaks, which he recently published in Marine Policy with Shane Orchard and Mauricio Dos Santos. I'm super stoked to have you on to talk about your research. Jesse and I first met back in 2020 at the Global Wave Conference in Gold Coast, Australia. I've since had the good fortune to join him at other conferences and to learn even more about his work. Suffice it to say, I'm amped to finally get you on the show. But before we get started, I want to thank you, Jesse, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Hey, Jason, thanks for having me on the podcast.
Of course, dude. I'm super stoked to finally get you to pin you down and get you on the show. Before we really get deep into all the work you do, I'm just curious, and maybe our listeners are as well, what compelled you to get into this line of work? You know, I know you're an attorney, but specifically what compelled you to go, you know, this route in terms of surf break protection?
Yeah, definitely. So it's kind of a circuitous route, but I was born in Arizona. And when I was 10, we moved to Florida. And so I taught myself to surf when I was 13 or 14 on the Gulf Coast of Florida. But I got really interested in coastal protection and ocean protection through actually reading Surfer Magazine and surfing magazines about the work that the Surf Rider Foundation did to protect beach access and to protect the coasts and beaches from, you know, everything from people trying to close off beach access to anything that could harm beaches, such as, oil pollution. So offshore drilling in Florida is a big issue. And, cruise ships pumping their garbage into the ocean, or their tanks into the ocean, things like that. So I got super interested into it, and I decided to focus on environmental protection. I actually worked as a protected species monitor on dredging projects throughout college. And then I had my, I focused on environmental studies as a minor when I was earning my undergrad degree. And then I had this idea that I really wanted to go to law school to work in this field. So to work in coastal protection and the ways that the law can protect the coasts and the oceans from, you know, being damaged. And so I went to law school. I actually also earned a master's of law, so an LLM, which no one ever knows what that means, but it's essentially the terminal degree for law. And so I focused on environmental and land use law there. And I was able to publish some articles on my first article on surf break protection, which was back when I was earning my master's of law. And so I always wanted to go into this career. I ended up getting a couple postdocs, so further training at Stanford's Center for Ocean Solutions and William & Mary Law School's Center for Coastal Policy. And then so I finally got a real job as a professor here in Rhode Island, where I get to focus on things like surf break protection, one of my research areas.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And, you know, I remember when we first met in the Global Wave Conference, you know, we're all the way over in Gold Coast, and, you know, here's this guy from, you know, from William & Mary, and then, you know, me being right down the road. That was pretty cool. You know, that was, since that presentation, I've been personally intrigued with your work. And I know, you know, we've had Dan Reinemann on, we've had Ed Atkin, two buddies of ours. And, you know, I know they do coastal resource management and among other things, of course, but, you know, I'm really glad to have you on to talk more about the sort of the legal ways we can protect surf breaks. And, you know, I just want to go ahead and get into it. And I have two questions. One, why is it important to legally protect surf breaks? And, you know, for the non-surfer, let's say, or even really for myself as a surfer, what do you all consider to be a surf break? Is it just the wave, or is it more?
Yeah. So the reason why, utilizing the law and either existing laws or designing new laws to protect surf breaks is important is because currently the coasts and the oceans don't seem like they're very populated or very crowded, but as more coastal uses become take up more of the coastline. So whether it's offshore wind development or aquaculture, which is a big issue up here in Rhode Island, they could potentially harm or infringe on surf breaks. So for instance, to kind of lead into the next question, the surf break itself, you think of like where the surf, where the wave actually breaks. So it's usually on like a rock, rocky surface or a reef or over sand. The sandbar or something like that. So there's that actual break itself. And then what we consider necessary to protect a surf break is also protecting some sort of access to that. And then also a wave corridor or a swell corridor so that the wave can actually come and break over that surf break. And so I think of it as being like kind of three components at least, and potentially more. But yeah, definitely access, the wave itself, so wherever it breaks, if it's a sandy spot or something like that, and then some sort of a wave for this wave to make it to break there. So a wave corridor. And essentially what that means, you don't actually have to protect that area. You don't partition that area off, but the idea is to like make sure a big, a harbor or a breakwater or something isn't put in there that would harm or degrade the surf break.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And, I had Dan and Ed on, and they talked a bit about, you know, wave and swell corridors. And, you know, I just find that even as a surfer, I find that fascinating, you know, the way we track swells and the way it interacts with the, you know, the contours of the ocean floor. And yeah. So, you know, thank you for, sort of clarifying what that means for you all legally. Mm-hmm. And, in your article, you define, or you all, you know, all of you guys that wrote this article together, you define surfing as the practice of harnessing and riding waves. And, you know, I found that just a really awesome and succinct way to define what we do. And, you know, it is, you guys made it sound so poetic and beautiful. And, you know, but to kind of segue into the article, you guys say that, you know, I'm quoting you all here, although non-statutory approaches have achieved some protection outcomes, there's demonstrable need for enforceable legally binding mechanisms to ensure effective protection of surf breaks. And, you know, I guess my question for you is, what have the non-statutory approaches been regarding surf break protection? And where has it been successful? And, you know, what are some of the ways you guys are sort of using that or going beyond that to protect surf breaks?
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up the poetic language. I think when I was writing papers with Dan Reinemann, he took a very, like, you know, I'm trying to think of a good word for it, but a very purposeful approach to explaining surfing to the non-surfer, right? So he explained what surfing was if you'd never even heard of it or something like that. So, and if you didn't really know what a wave was. So that's kind of what we do, is we want to explain it so that if you're a non-surfer, you can read this paper or one of our other papers and say, like, okay, I get it. I understand why it's important and why I should care about this issue. So yeah, thank you for pointing that out. That's kind of goes back to writing papers with people like Dan, who made sure that we pointed these things out to, like, a non-surfer audience, and kind of, we're always dealing with the negative implications of, like, the Spicoli effect of people thinking that surfing might not be this, like, righteous endeavor and it's just wasting your time or something. So we're very thoughtful about trying to explain what surfing is to a non-surfer. And yeah, so thank you for noticing that in the paper. And so, yeah, to get to your question, there have been these approaches such as, like, the World Surf Reserves, Australian Surf Reserves, and these potentially very important approaches to identifying important surf breaks and saying, okay, we know that this is an important surf break that should be prioritized for protection. Potentially those protections don't come with any legal teeth. So there's no corresponding legislation passed by, like, a local government, state government, or a federal government to give those protections any sort of legal consequences for developing, you know, that break. And so one thing that I would want to stress is that everyone knows these huge surf breaks, or sorry, these really important, like, world-class surf breaks that, like, Pipeline in Hawaii or, you know, Rincon in California, and these surf breaks that people are like, okay, obviously they're not going to build a, you know, resort or something that'll mess up that surf break. But actually that has happened in the past. So we're trying to protect these from potentially being, like, so Trestles was potentially endangered by building a toll road in California in Orange County. And so, like, people were just amazed that everyone knows that Trestles is a world-class surf break. They hold, you know, WSL events there sometimes, and yet it was still in the crosshairs of development. So you might think, like, oh, no one's going to develop Pipeline or do something to Pipeline, but it could potentially happen. And so to kind of put a finer point on it, even though we might have these World Surf Reserves, Australian Surf Reserves, or these places that we all can agree are important, they still could be endangered. So having some sort of a legal protection, whether it's just procedural, so saying, like, you have to consider that there's a surf break right next to this development, or, like, an actual protection of the area where you say, like, you can't develop this because it's a surf break. One of those approaches is potentially better than just saying, we all know and agree that this is a great place to surf without any corresponding legislation that protects it, and makes, you know, some sort of a penalty for violating that protection. And so, yeah, I'm trying to think if there was anything else. You asked about specific places. Yeah, so, you know, New Zealand has the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement. And then countries like Peru has, like, an actual law designed just for protecting surf breaks. But usually what we have in the U.S. is first of all, the law generally is very reactive. It's not very proactive. So we typically look to use these existing laws to protect surf breaks. But what the final stage of our research that this paper represents, the first stage, is to look at all the existing laws and the legal strategies and potentially lay out a framework or a blueprint for a legal protection strategy that could work just to protect surf breaks. So I don't know if that answered your question, but let me know if you have any follow-ups.
Yeah, no, it's great. And, you know, I'm, as you're talking, you know, I'm thinking, you know, you mentioned trestles, you've mentioned, you know, New Zealand, you've mentioned Peru, of course. And, you know, I maybe this is a bit of a loaded question. I don't know, but, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, so you and I are both surfers. Many of the people that listen to our podcast are also surfers, and, you know, a sport that we all love. And, but so beyond, I guess my question is beyond the mere act of surfing, right, with regard to these surf breaks, why do you think it's important to protect these breaks, right? So why protect trestles? Like, you know, someone who's not a surfer, you know, maybe they don't see the reason behind it. Let's say beyond just a bunch of individuals being able to paddle out and surf and have fun. And so, you know, what do you say to those individuals who would respond and say, you know, this seems to be a very surf-centered or even selfish endeavor? What is your response to them?
Yeah, that's something I never really thought about until we were listening to Tony Hawk's brother present, Steve. And he talked about how, you know, how it's kind of this individual pursuit. And I had never thought about it that way. I always think about, you know, first of all, my work being something that potentially helps, you know, protect these things for future generations. So whether it's a surf break or an ecosystem. And so there is this approach called like the surf ecosystem. And so that essentially ties the surf break to the natural wonders of whatever place is being protected. But yeah, I would say in response to that, a lot of people like to use the water, the beach, everything for many different pursuits, and keeping as many of these like natural wonders natural, I think is a reason to protect them in and of itself. But also like there should be places that are prioritized for surfing because, you know, it's something that's a valid pursuit, even though, you and I, you know, I kind of mentioned the Spicoli thing. And, you know, when the missionaries went to Hawaii and basically told the Hawaiians they shouldn't just sit around and surf anymore, even though they had already figured out, you know, their food for the next year and they didn't have to worry about protection and these other things. It's a very like recreational pursuit for recreation, but it's obviously tied to, you know, being good for mental health, being good for physical health, and also being very meditative. And it's one of these connections with nature that's pretty rare. And so even though people might malign it or say, you know, why should we protect this for surfing when we could do these, we could potentially use it for these other uses, I think there is an argument for protecting a surf break for surfing, but there are a whole host of other reasons to protect that piece of the ocean or the coast to be natural as well.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And, you know, it's you really in your answer really succinctly you sort of embody that answer, you know, really what lies at the heart of this, particularly this season of the Surfing Historian, you know, all the varying ways that surfing is important just beyond the mere activity itself. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, that's a great response. And I appreciate you, you know, sort of elaborating on that. Now I want to get into some of the legal stuff, you know, kind of continue in that vein, if you will. And, you know, you mentioned the World Surfing Reserves, which is an initiative of, you know, Save the Waves. And I guess, you know, kind of another two-part question. One, do you work with those groups like Save the Waves, for example? And beyond that, like, what are some of the biggest challenges and hurdles you faced in this work, in this endeavor to, let's say, protect surf breaks?
Yeah. So the main way I've kind of interacted with the Save the Waves folks is through the Global Wave Conference, which you've already mentioned. But they put that on with Surfrider every couple of years. So it's going to be this next month, supposedly, in Portugal. But yeah, so that's typically how I've worked with them. And I've met a lot of the people, I've read a lot of their work. I think they do really great work, and they do a good job of raising the profiles of these different surf breaks all around the world. And so they provide a really good service to kind of tie all these surf breaks together. One thing we've thought about, and it's actually something I'm working potentially with Dan Reinemann on right now, is so we have all these great surf breaks and we all agree that they're great, which I mentioned before, but what about the ones that kind of get left behind? So the legal framework can potentially give local communities or, you know, grassroots organizers this way to protect a surf break that people might not know about. So a surf break up in Del Norte County, California, or Humboldt County, California, that not many people have seen or heard of, but they want to make sure it's prioritized when they do end up putting, you know, offshore wind development, so turbines off the coast. So yeah, that's an important endeavor, I think, of this work, is to identify policies and initiatives that people who don't necessarily have this world-class break in their backyard, but still want to protect it. And so, yeah, I'm sorry, what was the second question again?
Oh, yeah, I guess, you know, just to kind of back up, you know, you mentioned the World Surfing Reserves and all that. And I guess, you know, you kind of answered them, but really I was curious to know, what are some of the, you know, your biggest challenges and hurdles?
Yeah. So it's everything from, well, I'll just say the most obvious one, which was when we were in Australia, you know, people were all excited about the recognition of the Gold Coast as this, you know, World Surf Reserve area. But trying to get the legislation that goes along with that, which they were actually keen on doing in Queensland, which is a state in Australia. But it potentially figuring out how that works. So like, let's say you have a World Surf Reserve, then figuring out how the political situation of wherever you are, whether it's in the United States or somewhere else in the world, is to actually figure out, once again, how to give actual legal protection to that place. And so there's going to be, you know, a lot of pushback. And so just even figuring out a good process for that, whether it's better to go more as like a regulatory policy side, or if it's better to do it as a statute, so like actual lawmaking or a regulation under an existing law. So all these different things are considerations for protecting a spot when you know you do want to protect it, but you're not necessarily sure what legal mechanism to use. And so that's why I think our work is very important in figuring out which legal mechanisms exist and where, and what potential future ones are that can be developed to meet this need.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And so, you know, I know the article we're sort of loosely talking about is, you know, you did with Mauricio Dos Santos and Shane Orchard as well. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of in line with what you were just talking about with these legal protections and whatnot, where do you come in this process? You know, maybe for the listener, because we've been talking about a lot of sort of ideas with regard to surf break protection, but where do you, and even, you know, with this article with Mauricio and Shane, like, where do you all come in, and at what point in this process do you, as a, say, a legal team, if you will, where do you come in?
Yeah. And so you mentioned these other researchers I've worked with, whether it's, you know, Dan Reinemann or Dave Revel or Ed Atkin. But yeah, Shane is also a little bit more on the policy side, but Mauricio and myself, we are both attorneys. So the idea is that we can research legal documents, legal instruments, and potential legislation, and even devise, so draft new legislation, new policies, new laws, because we know like the framework and what would be permissible in these different states and these different countries. And so I think that's the interesting approach that we have, which is we look at the actual legal protection framework. So that's what Shane did. He actually, you know, we did this project where we looked for existing legal mechanisms, and then we categorized them in this paper. And the next step in this process, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is trying to figure out, okay, we know that these different approaches already exist. Is there one of these that we think is the best? Is there a way that we can protect all three components of the surf break in one law? Or do we need to pass a suite of different laws? So do we need a marine protected area? And that's what Mauricio's background is in, is these MPAs. And he has pointed out himself that, you know, this is a potentially challenging approach for protecting surf breaks. And so we had a conversation about that a couple months ago. And when we're collaborating on this next paper, we're going to actually look at like, okay, well, a marine protected area to protect a wave corridor, a swell corridor would be great, but these are the challenges with that. So there's a lot of discussion about like how specific the marine protected area should be. And so marine protected areas can be everything from like they allow these listed uses in them to they don't allow much of anything. So just developing things like that and trying to be responsive to the needs of like protecting a surf break is going to be pretty interesting. And luckily we have these other experts on this project with me that can kind of help me with those issues.
Yeah. Thanks. You know, it is a fascinating, endeavor to protect these surf breaks. And as you said, Mauricio's area of expertise is marine protected areas. And, I know there's individuals that do work on that in, say, Nicaragua, where, you know, that's where I do most of my research, as you know, of course. But, you know, some of those marine protected areas, while it does, let's say, protect a surf break, has been known to have adverse effects on, say, the local fishing population or the local population who rely on some of those areas for fishing, for example. Can you speak to any of the adverse effects? Let's say it's okay. So we're protecting a surf break and we all agree that that's a good thing, but, are there any sort of, what are some of the negative consequences of this on say the local population? Are you familiar with any of those?
Well, we like to claim and say that we are a non-extractive use. So surfing doesn't take anything out of the water. It doesn't build anything. So actually, we like to at least say that we don't have any deleterious effects on local communities, or, you know, we don't have any unintended consequences of protecting these surf breaks. But yeah, I mean, I guess if you wanted me to kind of come up with a hypothetical, yeah, if you did design like a marine protected area that was for, you know, non-extractive use, so essentially like a no-take zone where previously you were able to go and, you know, take lobster, go fishing and do these other things in that area, that could have a consequence on the economies of, you know, small states or things like that. So that is something to consider. But luckily, we are a non-extractive use surfers. And so your research, I'm sure you can answer this much better than I can, as far as colonialism, pollution, and other things that come with potentially using these things for surfing areas. So once again, to have this kind of hypothetical, if you do say this is a protected area, you might have the local community, like they've done in El Salvador, say, like, you know, this is Surf City. This is where you should come to surf. So everyone should fly here and surf. And then you might have unintended or intended consequences of that being very negative, whether it's a lot of people coming and just leaving their trash on the beach, colonial effects of like essentially the white man coming and using these things and really disregarding the needs of local communities. So yeah, that is something that your research more falls in line with, and others have written about this as well. That's like more on the surf tourism side. But like I said, hopefully we would have very minimal and like there wouldn't be any of those negative effects, and it would be at the grassroots level. So it'd be very locals focused. And those are the people who you would want to engage if you did want to pass one of these local laws, and you would try to be mindful of any negative consequences that I've just mentioned.
Yeah, you know, thanks for that. And, you know, the just the honesty in your answer, you know, I really appreciate that. And, you know, you've mentioned Ed, you've mentioned Dan, you know, you work with a whole host of people, and, you know, it's you guys are doing amazing work. And, you know, one of the places, at least, you know, in talking in my conversation with Ed and, you know, just talking with all of you guys, and of course, in this article you've written, it seems to me that New Zealand is doing a really wonderful job, let's say, of protecting surf breaks. Mm-hmm. In your article, you note that there's 7 surf breaks of what you all, or I guess New Zealand, defines as national significance. Raglan being one of those, which, you know, I think you mentioned in the article, and I think our listeners are pretty familiar with that one. But but would you, you know, sort of in considering New Zealand's efforts to protect these breaks or label them as significant nationally, what could you offer some insight from a legal perspective in terms of what they're doing so well and why they stand out as you know, maybe being remarkable in terms of this this campaign to protect breaks?
Yeah, I think there were 17. But yeah, there's a bunch, and they could be added to. So the New Zealand approach and the New Zealand coastal policy statement is to kind of identify these surf breaks. And actually, when I was doing my research for my first Law Review article on this topic, I was super bummed out because my whole idea was essentially, you know, made moot by the fact that New Zealand had already done all this work. So luckily I was still able to, you know, essentially publish my findings and say that New Zealand has a good approach, and that, you know, in the US we'd have to rely on these existing laws. So you think of things like the National Historic Preservation Act, which has been used to kind of protect Malibu. And these different approaches, national monuments could potentially be used, marine protected areas, we've already talked about a little bit. But yeah, so New Zealand kind of leads the way. And the main reason I would say that they do is that they've taken a very purposeful approach to protect surf breaks for being surf breaks. So Ed, you know, he works on actually saying, like, his research actually says, like, this surf break is important for these reasons. So they actually have people working on that, which, you know, if you hired someone to do that, I'm sure they do it. They do it in the US as well. It's been used in local coastal programs in California to say, like, this area has, you know, very important surf breaks. And that's something you should think about when you're being mindful of development and thinking about zoning and different uses in different areas that are in the coastal zone. So yeah, New Zealand's been very thoughtful. Other countries like Peru and Chile have also passed laws that specifically are intended to protect surf breaks. New Zealand, it's it's been, I think, a little bit more successful. I'm not sure. The Peruvian law, I think, lacked some of the enforcement that we're talking about elsewhere. And so it's great because they specifically protect surf breaks, you know, surf waves, rompimientos. But New Zealand does stand out for the fact that they've taken this approach to actually protect surf breaks, to say which ones they want to protect, to allow for more surf breaks to be added to that list, which, once again, I mentioned, we don't want to like leave any surf breaks behind. That's the potentially problematic approach aspect of trying to catalog all these waves and saying like, these ones are important. And guess what? Since the one that is potentially imperiled is not on that list, we can just develop there. Like there is that potential unintended consequence that we want to avoid. So we do want to have some sort of an adaptive approach that allows new surf breaks to be added and things like that. So I think those are some of the reasons why the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement has been so successful and why they've kind of led the way.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And, you know, it's, as you're talking, I'm sitting here thinking, my university students, you know, in teaching a history of surfing class, they're like, man, I just thought people just went out and surfed. I didn't realize there was so much that surrounds this sport we all love. And I think, you know, just in what you're saying right there, really sort of encapsulates or embodies sort of the nuanced nature of all of our work, whether it's history, whether it's, you know, surf break protection or, you know, coastal resource management, and all the different things that, you know, we talk about and we've had on the podcast. But yeah, you know, it's just fascinating work. And the idea that, you know, an attorney, of course, an attorney in your case that loves surfing, is involved in such a nuanced process to protect not just the waves, as you said, but this surfing ecosystem, everything that sort of surrounds the surf break. Yeah, you know, it's just fascinating work. And like I said, you know, I've said it in the intro, I've said it, you know, probably already before in this, you know, episode and interview, like, you know, just from even hearing you guys, you know, present at the Global Wave Conference, I was just fascinated that, you know, the links that people are going to protect these areas that we all value. And, you know, you mentioned Peru, you've mentioned it a number of times. And of course you talk about it in your chapter. And, you know, you say that, I think it's Peru and Australia, if I'm not mistaken, that they use a bottom-up approach. And I know, you know, as a historian, I understand what that means, you know, from a bottom-up approach to studying history. But in your line of work, in regard to Peru and I guess Australia, what does that mean for you all in terms of legally protecting surf?
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Breaks. Yeah, I mean, I think it's essentially actors besides a government, so essentially like grassroots or some sort of an NGO or something leading the way. They both Australia and Peru, we note in the paper that that those are ones where these NGOs, third parties, have had these key roles in determining which surf breaks should be nominated for protection. So once again, like, we don't want necessarily there to be a process where a government, whether it's state, local, or federal, says like, these are the surf breaks that should be protected. We want the communities to kind of make those decisions, because once again, we are mindful of these potential issues in the past, whether it's in Hawaii with colonial issues and other places, where we want these decisions really to be driven by the communities and not necessarily some, you know, top-down approach where the government says, these are the five we can protect and there's not going to be any other. So we really want to make it a grassroots approach where the communities and the NGOs and the people who do have the expertise and the and understand the issue and the reasons for these areas needing to be protected, that they kind of lead the way.
Yeah, that's, you know, I kind of assume that's what you were talking about, but I'd rather, you know, have you, of course, explain it. And so, yeah, it's, you know, sort of valuing the input of that, the local knowledge, the sort of grassroots, as you said, nonprofits and others. And that's amazing. And, you know, I want to sort of steer the conversation towards one of your subsections that it was actually just classification of protection mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And just to kind of get, you know, pick your brain a little bit on this, you know, obviously with Dan, we've talked a little bit about climate change and how that impacts, you know, of course, coastal resource management and surf breaks. Mm-hmm. But how, and specifically in your line of work with legally protecting surf breaks, how has climate change and sea level rise impacted your work in terms of protecting these areas? And so, I guess where I'm going with that is, do you have to redraw the lines, you know, quote unquote, of these protected areas as high tide lines sort of extend? I think you all in your article, you refer to it as climate responses, but would you mind speaking to that?
Yeah, I mean, the climate change and sea level rise is going to drive a lot of changes, you know, climate changes in where surf is good, where it's better, and where it's previously not been an important thing, but will become an important activity in a certain area. So, yeah, there's surf breaks that will be, quote unquote, drowned, where a wave previously broke in a spot that will no longer break there because it's just too deep. So that's definitely an issue. And that's why we need some sort of like a nimble response in these legal mechanisms to respond to that. And it's very problematic. As I mentioned earlier, the law is very reactive. It's not proactive. So people will say like, we should protect this in the future, but they don't necessarily, you know, say all surf breaks should be protected until they're shown to be unimportant anymore. So we have this very reactive approach in policymaking and lawmaking that will be very challenging in the wake of climate change and sea level rise. But yeah, to your question, you'll have to determine new spots. Potentially surf breaks will have these new areas. So you as you mentioned, like drawing the new lines of protection, and that's kind of why that you should probably take into account any potential sea level rise in the next 50 or 100 years when you do try to draw these lines. But yeah, it's going to be a problem. As you mentioned, Dan Reinemann works on this a lot, you know, talking about how the surfers are kind of the canaries in the coal mine, because we go out there and we actually see the changing topography and we see how the waves change, whereas someone who's a casual beachgoer might not. And so we might say that, you know, that wave broke over there and now it doesn't anymore. So it could be because the sea level is rising or some erosive event, which, you know, could itself be caused or worsened because of climate change. So it all fits together, and it's all important part of trying to make policy for the beaches and for surf breaks that protect them.
Yeah, it's I was kind of thinking about that as I was reading your article, and you gave a very tangible answer to my question I'm about to ask you. But so other than drawing lines and anticipating, let's say, sea level rise, which it sounds like that's something you guys are obviously very mindful of, what do you suggest? Because you've been saying that there a lot of these policies are reactive, they're not proactive. So other than, let's say, anticipating sea level rise or drawing the line a little further up, for lack of a better term, what do you suggest should change to make these approaches more proactive and less reactive? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think including some sort of an adaptive management principle in the law. So saying, like, currently, these are the conditions, but when this thing is triggered or when this event happens, then, we relook at it. So making the policymakers come back to the table or draw the lines again in response to some sort of a erosive event or some sort of a trigger being triggered. That's what I think could be included in a law that would require them to say, okay, we used to think this was where we should protect these surf breaks, but we've decided that we have to reconsider these because the sea level has risen so much or some other condition has occurred that requires us to come back and reconsider it. So I think that's what I would consider a good approach. But as you mentioned, the law is it's hard to change a law after you've passed it. So trying to think of all these things and including them when you first draft the law, I think, is important.
Well, yeah, and just in our conversation, I'm getting a much better sense of how nuanced and multifaceted all of your line of work is. Not obviously, most everyone understands the work many attorneys do, but seeing how you have applied this to our world, surfing and protecting surf breaks and all that is it's fascinating. And of course, I want to, as a friend and just as someone who I think is doing some amazing work in the world, I just want to, commend you for you and Mauricio and Dan and all of you who are really working to protect not just the spots where we surf, but the broader ecosystem of it. And, we've been talking a lot about you as an attorney and a number of these other individuals as scholars, the mm-hmm. work that you all are doing, but what as an ordinary surfer, right? Or let's say a normal citizen, what can we do? How can we come alongside and be part of this, this effort?
Yeah, sure. So I think the best thing would be to join an organization like Save the Waves or the Surfrider Foundation, get involved with their local chapters, and get to know your elected officials, whether it's at the local level, the state level, or the federal level. It's their job to be responsive to you. So you can call your congressperson and leave a message. And if one of these surf breaks is in their jurisdiction, they'll hopefully be responsive to it. I think local level is, the most important. And so grassroots organizing, whether it's trying to find a new candidate, if your current candidate isn't being responsive to your needs is something that you can do. But yeah, I would start at joining a coastal protection NGO and getting involved with them and then seeing where that leads.
Awesome, Jesse. Yeah. And, for the listener, I think at this point, everybody knows, they can go to surfinghistorian.com and we have, a huge list of NGOs that you can get plugged into that are doing the work that you're talking about. And, I'm glad you, just offered some insight as to how many of us can, can get involved and support your work and the work of others who are doing, you know, wonderful things around the world. And so, you know, Jesse, I am just super stoked that I was able to pin you down and bring you on to the show. And, you know, obviously huge thanks to you. And with that, I just want to go ahead and give you the last word.
Yeah, Jason, thanks for having me on. It's great to be a part of this podcast. I look forward to seeing who else you get in the future. And thanks for bringing me on and for talking about these important issues.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Jesse about his research on surf break protection, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by anthropologist Dr. Stefan Kraus. He and I will be chatting about his research on surf tourism in Costa Rica, as well as his research on the preservation of traditions and customs on the island of Yap in the nation of the Federated States of Micronesia. If these topics pique your interest, then this will certainly be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Banana Bag Oral Solution again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at bananabag.org. And while you're there, use promo code STAYSTOKED for 10% off your purchase. Be sure to join their mailing list too if you want free shipping. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.